We celebrated Purim twice in 1967. We celebrated Purim as a commemoration of the great deliverance from Haman. And then in June, we celebrated the great deliverance of our people in Israel from the 11 nations which had determined to eradicate them. 1967 began with a series of attacks by Syrian guns and tanks on Israeli settlements in the Galilee. These attacks mounted in furor and intensity, and all the attempts of world diplomacy to abate them, to end the terrorism and the gunfire, proved futile. Throughout the spring, the intensity of planning for what the Arabs delight to call the final solution to the Palestine problem grew in fervor and in frenzy. And finally, on the 17th of May, General Nasser requested the United Nations to remove the border patrols from the Sinai. On the 18th of May, the United Nations Emergency Force was ordered out of Sinai by Secretary General U Thant. On the very same day, the Egyptians began massing their troops in the Sinai and put their troops in that little fortress at the Straits of Tiran, whose guns can control the straits and prevent the movement of ships into the Gulf of Aqaba. And it was announced that hereafter and forever, Israel's oil route to the east would be closed, and no Israeli flagship and no ship bound for Israel would be allowed to pass up into the Gulf of Aqaba to Eilat. The Imam in Cairo, the highest official of the Egyptian Muslim Church, proclaimed a holy war. Nasser ordered his printing office to prepare a series of stamps commemorating his great recapture of Palestine. One of the anomalies of the situation was that this so-called holy war was being subvented and supplied by that unholy atheistic government in Moscow, and that it was the Russians who had in the past 3 years given to the Syrians and to the Egyptians almost $3 billion worth of swift jet planes and powerful tanks and ground-air missiles and all of the rest of modern armor, without which any attack on Israel would have been inconceivable. Now, the attempts of the Western powers in the last 2 weeks of May to abort the war, because the closing of an international waterway to a nation is a war, is an act of war. The attempt of the Western powers to avert this war proved once again the wisdom of the biblical adage, Al tiftachu bin divim, put not your trust in princes. The United States, Great Britain, and other powers deplored the Arab action. There were demands that the United Nations exert its peacekeeping activities on behalf of peace in the Middle East. Our own government tried desperately to organize, as we recall, a group of the maritime powers of the West so that a Western convoy might challenge the blockade of the Straits of Tiran. But it was all to no avail. Added up only to the single statement that Israel should hold fast, that it should hold still while the noose was being drawn more tightly around its neck. Because in politics, as in life, it's the deed and not the word that counts. And the last years, the Arabs have learned that the deeds are Russian and the words are Western. That they have nothing to fear from the gentle verbal slap on the wrist which is given to them occasionally by the chanceries of the West. For 4 or 5 years now, the Arabs have been increasing the degree of their infiltration of Israel. The al-Fatah had been abroad. 60% of the Security Council and General Assembly time of the United Nations has been concerned with peacekeeping in the Middle East, and the sum and substance of it all is that not a single resolution of censure against the Arab world has been passed. Not a single effective peacekeeping device has been created. And that, in fact, the only time when there has been some statement of so-called judgment by the world body, it has been against Israel when she felt it necessary to take some military retaliatory action against those countries from which the marauders were infiltrating and bringing in their loads of dynamite and death. Israel was told, stand still, be patient. And Israel was patient for a week and the second week. And then early in June, an Egyptian tank attack was begun against the Negev. The Israeli planes went into operation, and in 6 swift days, the Israeli courage vanquished Russian arms and Arab armies. It was a costly victory, albeit a swift one. 800 young men killed in action, almost 3,000 young men severely wounded. In respect to our population, the United States would have to receive almost 90,000 casualties in South Vietnam in a single 6-day period in order to equal the burden of tears and heartache which Israel had to bear. But for the moment, the danger was lifted, the noose was pulled from the neck, and the world was presented with a rare opportunity to use its political, its economic power, finally to stabilize conditions in the Middle East. The world in June had an opportunity to bring about those conditions which would see that all nations of the world had guaranteed boundaries, and that the nations in that part of the world abandoned these hopeless and hapless programs of genocide, destroy one of their neighbors. But the last 6 months of 1967 showed that the world was not prepared to exert itself truly to achieve peace. Time and again, an opportunity was offered itself, and the opportunity was abandoned. Israel said early after the victory that no item was not negotiable, that Israel demanded only the recognition of her sovereignty, that once she was guaranteed stable borders and relationships of peace and security with her neighbors, all other outstanding issues from boundaries to refugees could be negotiated, and the world by and large was not ready to press for such a solution. In July, the Soviet Union began a massive airlift of supplies to Syria and to Egypt. Within 4 months, she had resupplied these two nations with more than 100% of the equipment which they had had before the Sinai campaign. The Arab armies today have greater firepower, more sophisticated weapons, faster planes, ground-to-ground missiles, and a larger submarine and destroyer fleet than they had before. All this in 4 months. And the Soviet Union has made it clear that if the Arabs intend to attack again, there are ways in which the Soviet Union can shield them from other dangers. She has docked part of her Mediterranean fleet at Port Said and at Alexandria, where their guns actually could fire over Israeli positions in the Sinai. On December 3rd, the Soviet Union completed a flight of heavy jet bombers from Odessa to Cairo, some 4,250 miles, a flight which was designed to prove simply the kind of umbrella protection which she could provide to Egypt if Egypt determined on another act of war. It was Russian missiles which sunk the Israeli destroyer Eilat in the open seas off of the Sinai. And it was, in all probability, Russian technicians which manned the firing of those missiles. If there is a fourth round in the Middle East, the guilt for that round will lie on the shoulders of the Soviet Union. And it will be a heavy guilt. Encouraged by the decisiveness of Soviet actions, the so-called moderates of the Arab world abandoned their moderation. And the so-called moderates conference at Khartoum in August, which was designed to find acceptable formulae for peace negotiations, turned into a war conference. Nasser came, Nasser told of his defeat, and he told of his needs, and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Libya and the other oil-rich states said, fine, here is an annual belligerency allowance, $400 million a year, use it for what you will, as long as what you use it for are arms to be used against Israel. The Arab world is busy today rebuilding, refashioning, reforging the weapons and the armies which were destroyed in June. There is to be another summit conference in Morocco at the end of the month, which will be another war conference. The Arab world has already begun to restructure the Palestine Liberation Organization, the group of Arab refugee marauder volunteers who were recruited right in the refugee camps supplied by refugee funds and Russian arms, and who have been the backbone of the saboteurs and the marauders who have crossed again and again into Israeli territory. The old bombastic orator Ahmed Zoukeri is out, and a new group of far more efficient political and military leaders are in. Russia precluded the possibility of moderation in the Arab world. And Arab leaders deluded themselves that there will and can be another round and that it can be more successful, and it is this for which they are planning, and not for peace. And in the West, we saw in the last months of the year the sorry spectacle of erstwhile friends of countries which pride themselves on their traditions of principle, deserting those principles for oil and for mineral rights and for Arab markets. France, which had for many years been the major supplier of arms to Israel, France searching for new relationships with Algeria, searching for new relationships with its old mandated territory in Syria, from which the English had, in a sense, elbowed them out some 20 years ago. France, under the hard-boiled leadership of General de Gaulle, turned its policy 180 degrees, imposed an arms embargo on Israel, voided a two-year-old jet airplane sale of Mirage fighter bombers to Israel, and turned around and sold those very bombers to Iraq, whose air force had been the air force which had bombed Netanya in June. France also began to develop economic ties with Lebanon and with Syria. In return for phosphate and for oil, France promised economic aid and trade advantages, and the arms embargo on Israel is maintained, a particularly difficult embargo for Israel to bear because her air force is largely French supplied and depends upon spare French parts. England facing a $225 million a year deficit because of the closing of the Suez. England abandoned principle and began to speak at the United Nations of the internationalization of Jerusalem, of the need for immediate withdrawal. Only American pressure kept England voting with Washington on the various United Nations resolutions. England in the last 6 weeks has sent an ambassador to Cairo an old Bevanite, Mr. Beeley, an old anti-Semite, an old Arabist of the Foreign Office, and England is determined to find ways in which to court Mr. Nasser. In the West, really only the United States stayed firm. In June, shortly after the war, President Johnson announced five basic principles of American policy, and they were these: mutual recognition of the political independence and territorial integrity of all countries in the area, encompassing recognized boundaries and other arrangements, including disengagement and withdrawal of forces that will give all countries security against terror, destruction, and war, freedom of innocent maritime passage, just and equitable solution of the refugee problem, registration and limitation of arms shipment into the area, recognition of the right of all sovereign nations to exist in peace and security. At the United Nations, the United States remained firm in these commitments, and that firmness prevented the United Nations from voting authorization for the greed of the world. By that I mean that it was only the determination of the United Nations which precluded the Soviet and the Eastern Bloc, the Arab-Asian Bloc, the so-called neutralist Bloc, and the greedy nations of the West from voting at the United Nations resolutions which would have put the onus of all action on Israel, ordered Israel to return to the boundaries of May of 1967 without any hard security agreements, and continued the war, the Cold War, in the Middle East at now a position which was to Israel's disadvantage. The United States remained firm, and finally, when Mr. Jarring was empowered as the representative of the United Nations to go to the Middle East, the resolution of his commission was won largely in terms of the American position. The United States remained firm at the United Nations, but we were not as firm or as decisive in other areas. In June, the United States put an embargo on all arms shipments into the Middle East. It required 3 months before the United States would release to Israel some 48 Skyhawk jet bombers which had been bought by Israel here in the United States some 2 years ago. Israel lost over 40 aircraft in the June war. These planes were desperately needed simply to return the Israeli Air Force to its pre-war measure and level. During the time when Israel was pressing for these Skyhawk bombers, the State Department was making it clear to the press that there was no need to fear the Russian resupply of Egypt, that the Israelis were exaggerating the degree of that resupply. When it became clear that Russia was in earnest, and that in fact the Egyptian forces were better equipped by December of 1967 than they had been in May of 1967, the State Department began to make clear to the press that though the quantitative superiority lay with the Egyptians, Israel was qualitatively superior. Its fighting men, its officer corps had proven their worth, and therefore the administration should reject Israeli request for further arms shipments until full explorations had been taken with the Soviet Union, of all people, to see whether or not an arms limitation agreement could not be worked out with the Middle East. Russia's answer was to increase the shipment of arms to Syria. Israel's answer was to speed the Prime Minister, Mr. Eshkol, to the United States, where he is today, to meet with Mr. Johnson, who has been till now far more understanding of Israel's needs in the State Department, to see to it whether or not these arms so desperately needed cannot be gotten. The answer is still unknown. Israel requires arms for deterrence. Israel requires arms to maintain the fighting power which she had in June. The world has a strange way of looking at military situations. They assume that because you won one war or a battle in the war, you will win all the battles. And they also assume that because you have won a battle, somehow the sympathy of the world should shift to those that have lost. There's a British satirist who writes in the London Observer by the name of Michael Feeney. Just 7 days after the war, Mr. Feeney wrote a little letter to Israel which he called Dear Israel. And I'd like to read to you part of it. He wrote, "Dear Israel, we shouldn't have let you down. If things had gone badly, we had ships standing by which could have evacuated several thousand of your survivors, and they would have had the unreserved sympathy of the entire world. But you took it upon yourself to win, and you have no doubt learned to your cost what the world thinks of nations that win wars. I'm sure you will agree that you should not profit in any way from this unfortunate state of affairs. Undoubtedly, you must go to your neighbors without delay and hand back to every one of them the territories which you inadvertently occupied during the fighting. No doubt your task will be complicated by your neighbors' continued refusal to recognize your existence, but you just do your best and whistle while you work." The world during 1967 lost a golden opportunity to bring peace into the Middle East. The world during 1967 proved once again that the chanceries of the world, whatever their high-minded principles of their long-worded white papers, that their major concern is with markets and with economic advantage and with the larger political configurations of the world, and the principle simply does not play a major role. The world during 1967 looked for every way to placate the Arabs, to forget that they had brought the war about. Israel began to be spoken about as aggressive, as imperialistic, as expansionist, forgetting that neither in 1947 nor in 1967 had it been Israel which had demanded or wanted the chain of events, the confrontation, which led to war. And the nations looked not to lose the large Arab oil fields, the large mineral deposits in North Africa and the Sahara region. The world looked to the advantages of the Arab markets, and the world tried every way it could to avoid a direct confrontation, standing up and saying, the Israeli cause for peace and for security is a just one. Now let's go about and build it and make it work. By November, Mr. Eshkol had to remind the world that though Israel was prepared to negotiate all the outstanding issues, Israel demanded direct negotiations, not temporization, not empty words, not fruitless, hopeless formulae, but direct across-the-table negotiations with the 11 nations which had declared war upon her. He wrote then, and this remains the basis of Israel's policy, "The prospects of future peace depend on three main factors: Israel's capacity for deterrence and defense, non-intervention of the powers in the area on the side of those who declare before the world that they are not prepared to sit down at the conference table for peace talks, and that all they desire is to destroy and annihilate a member state of the United Nations. And thirdly, that the powers and the United Nations should avoid obscure and meaningless formulae like declarations on the cessation of belligerency without a real peace settlement. These empty declarations can only have the perilous result of strengthening those who are bent on war. I wish to warn all those who resort to obscure formulae that they are undertaking a grave responsibility for the deterioration of the position in the area. There is no sense and no advantage in trying to determine peace terms through mediating forces. Only direct negotiations can bring a solution to the problems of the area. Only direct contact, which can open up the way to mutual understanding between the parties." But what shall we say? As 1967 closes, the possibility, the needs of deterrence are greater than they were before through Russian action. The world, especially the Eastern world, has intervened on behalf of the Near Eastern Arab states. And the powers that be at the UN have tried in every way possible to intervene and to intercede and to preclude direct negotiations between Israel and her neighbors. 1967 closes without peace. It closes, however, with one important plus, and that is Israel's recognized ability to control effectively her larger territories. Israel in June captured over 1 million Arabs in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and a few in the Golan Heights. She has shown that she has the ability to maintain her security, to maintain her new borders, and to rigidly but principally reorganize and raise the economic level of all of these peoples. Israel has raised the standard of living of many of the Arabs who now find themselves in her country. She has brought to the refugees better schooling, better social care, a higher degree of economic activity than they knew before. She has ruled these territories with needed diligence because the El-Fateh have been abroad in the land. Israel has captured 300 of these marauders and killed another 50 during their attacks and their terrorization. But she has ruled even-handedly and firmly, and she has shown to these Arabs by opening up all of Israel to their travel, by giving them the continuity of their local leadership, their mayors and their city councils all remained in power. She has shown to them that she has no murderous designs upon them as people, as the Arab propaganda had claimed. And she has shown her ability to deal with the many personal and human problems thrown up by the war. Mr. Comey, on behalf of the State of Israel, said to the United Nations just a few weeks ago that Israel was willing to engage in a 5-year crash program with all the nations of the world to finally rehabilitate the Arab refugee. That there was no problem inherent in the refugee problem which could not be solved. It was a problem of education, it was a problem of their reintegration into the economies of the countries in which they were. That if other nations would cooperate, Israel would cooperate and give that cooperation high priority. And the world, the Arab world at least, cold-shouldered this proposal. Because the Arab refugees to the Arab states are not a humane problem, but a political ploy. They represent some $30 million of dollars of income from international funds. They represent a ready recruiting grounds for the marauders and the saboteurs. They represent a source of subversion for in Jordan against the royalist monarchy. And they represent very importantly, in the West, an important emotional appeal to those in the West who let their hearts rule their minds, who care about refugees, do not ask whence they came and why they may remain refugees, and if continuing to dole them out a meal here and a garment there is in fact the greater kindness. The year ends with Israel's ability to maintain the present boundaries for as long as it is necessary for the Arab world to recognize that they must sit down ultimately and deal across the table with all the issues between the nations. Will there be peace? Very little that's happened in the last 6 months can make us hopeful. But Israel has shown time and again that when there is determination and courage, a great deal can happen which one does not expect. And Israel has the courage and the determination. And on that note, we must end this part of our survey. Now, this June war was the single most important event in Jewish history in 1967. Because this June war not only affected and made possible the survival of Israel, but it affected Jewish communities throughout the world. In Libya, the 4,500 Jews of Libya were exposed to a terrible pogrom. which killed many of them. All the shops and synagogues in the ghetto were burnt. Jews' children were taken up to the rooftops in the ghetto and simply hurled by the young toughs into the streets. The 25,000 Jews of Egypt were forced to register. All the heads of the families were imprisoned. For 5 months, the Egyptian government refused to allow even the International Red Cross to visit these men in the prisons where they were tortured and many of them were killed. Just recently, a few were finally released. The 4,000 Jews of Syria were locked into their ghetto in Damascus, and the doors of the ghetto were opened only during the day to allow the young toughs to roam through the streets, attacking the weak and the young, and bruising all that they wished to. In the Soviet Union, the six-day war brought about not only a recrudescence, a renewal of anti-Zionist propaganda, but a renewal of that traditional Eastern European anti-Semitism, which has now and again shown itself despite the protestations of the various communist governments. Typical of the approach of the Soviet Union to the June War, its callous, unprincipled reaction to it, is this editorial, which I found in Pravda, dated June 18th. The kind of reporting that was repeated again and again and again and is still being repeated throughout the Eastern Bloc. This is their interpretation of the June War. The unprecedented punishment and attack upon the Arab population by the Israeli occupiers has taken on a mass, premeditated, and organized character. This is an action aimed at the greatest possible annihilation of the Arab population. This is genocide, one of the most terrible crimes condemned by the civilized world and international law. When one reads the reports of these crimes, terrible pictures of the recent past arise in the memory. The ovens of Maidenbeck and Auschwitz blaze up. Enormous pits yawn, filled to the brim with the corpses of those who have been shot. German fascism intended to annihilate entire peoples. 12 million peaceful people found death in the murder trucks and gas chambers and by the bullets of the Hitlerites' submachine guns. It is no accident that it was precisely the verdict of guilty in the case of the principal German war criminals which became the first international document in which that monstrous word genocide was cited. Israel then is guilty somehow of genocide. The very careful, the very humane activity of the Israeli soldiery is never mentioned. The fact that Israel went to war only when it was forced to war is never considered. But Israel has become the agent of Western imperialism and has become, by some strange paradox, the modern symbol of Nazism. During the last months of the year, various small groups of Jews in the Ukraine, in Belarus, and Poland were subjective to mob violence. Local newspapers began to have again those cartoons which were shown five, 6 years ago in the Russian press, the long-nosed Jew with the eyes which are simply dollar signs, grasping for the gold and for the land and for control of the world. We continue to hope for that the 3 million plus Jews of the Eastern Bloc might be released from this slavery. We understood what the terms free world meant as we prayed for their deliverance. But the deliverance was not yet here. And the June War and the 101% pro-Arab position taken by the Soviet Union, plus the old traditions of Eastern anti-Semitism, were combining to make life very difficult for the Jews of Eastern Europe. In the United States, in Western Europe, in Latin America, the June War brought about an unprecedented rally of interest and of concern, a rally which was both political and philanthropic in its nature. You recall how here in Cleveland is simply an example of what happened throughout the nation. Jews came together and gave of their savings and gave in proportions like unto which they had never given before to the various funds which could support and shore up the Israeli economy. Jews rallied in Washington and Paris and London and Buenos Aires, throughout the free world, asking support and understanding by their governments for the plight of Israel. There was a great sense of power, of confraternity, of peoplehood within our communities, probably more than we had recognized that there ever had been before. We had been for many years living in a world of self-doubt. I remember one Sunday in June, I had been over at Western Reserve University, and I had talked to a group there that had where we had approached them about going to Israel to do home front work during the war. 250 of the young people on the campus, 250 out of only 800 Jewish youngsters there, had volunteered for this service. And I had come home when I had turned on briefly the television, and there had been a pre-recorded television program on the vanishing American Jewish youth. We had lived in this atmosphere of fear. We had had a sense that we were losing our identity, that we were losing the spirit of the young, when in fact we simply had not made sufficient demands on their commitment. We had talked more of the ceremonial than of the challenging. Our schools were more ritual than relevant. Our activities were more pledge card than direct service. Our young people wanted something which was much more of life, in life. And when that demand was made on them, they responded nobly. But in the West, too, though we take great pride in this achievement, this dollar achievement, this political achievement of last year, in the West, too, we were forced to recognize that the victory of June brought about a certain renaissance of anti-Jewish feeling. And not only on the right, in those traditional reservoirs of anti-Semitic hate, the Klan and the White Christian Crusade and places of this kind. We found anti-Semitism, strangely, in the extreme left, among the Rap Browns and the Stokely Carmichaels, among those members of the Black Nationalist group who defined some identity and some strength, had allied themselves with what's called the Afro-Asian bloc. They had forgotten that for centuries, for millennia, it was the Arab world which had engaged in the slave trade, which had brought the blacks out of Africa and misused them throughout the world. They forgot that even today in Somaliland and in Ethiopia, it was Arabs which were going about a deliberate campaign of genocide against native black tribes. They saw only the possibility of funneling some Syrian, Cairo, Algiers money into their crusade, the need to write for themselves a new history. And so they took over all the shibboleths of the Arab League, and they began printing in their newspapers Arab League cartoons about the grasping, demanding, violent, blood-sucking Jew. We began to hear this kind of anti-Semitism from the extreme left. In a more genteel form, we began to see this kind of anti-Jewish feeling in the churches of the United States, especially in the Protestant churches. Protestant theology has never known what to do with a reborn Israel. We should be the wandering Jew. We should be the suffering Jew. If we were suffering, their sympathies would be all with us. But here we are, masters of a state. Here we are, masters of a state which can defend itself against 11 foreign armies. Here we are, obviously staking our claim and our right to survive. And theologically, this is a very difficult concept for the church to maintain, especially difficult for a church which has tremendous emotional roots in missionary activity among the Arab masses. One of the most surprising sights in Israel, in the West Bank, as you travel through, is the lavishness of building which these Protestant churches have raised for themselves in almost every Arab village. There'll be a hospital, but it'll be surrounded with beautiful quarters for the resident staff, or a school with a magnificent dormitory for the teachers and for the principal. In every community, they have staked out for themselves a proprietary claim as spiritual patroons. And all of this, of course, is being threatened. And we began to see publicly, and even more so privately, questions of suspicion of Jewish principle. Who were we really? We obviously were no longer those strange but beloved biblical characters which Protestant children can color into their Sunday school texts. Nor were we any longer those groups who delighted once a year to scrape our foreheads on the floor as we welcomed at some Brotherhood Week celebration our non-Jewish business friends into our congregations. We were standing up for something. We had a backbone. You'd have to consider us as human beings. By and large, large groups within the Protestant community, especially within the church community, were not prepared to see the Jew in this light. Fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, the larger groups in the United States are not that dominated by their theology, that they were much infected by it. But in the groups of the clergy, in the American Academy of Religion, this was the mood. Pro-Arab, unwilling to discuss the issues as issues, unwilling to see the principles as principles, demanding withdrawal, demanding internationalization of Jerusalem, talking about concern for the survival of Israel, to be sure, but only once Israel has shown its right, in quotation marks, to survive. 1967, then, was a year featured by the June War. It was a year in which the world began to awaken to the fact that the existence of the State of Israel is a fact, and in which it had to come to some understanding and some acceptance of that fact, in which Jews throughout the world came to realize both the pluses and the minuses of the existence of the state in their lives. It is Israel, more than any other factor, which dominates our lives as Jews. In the Argentine, where there are some 200,000 Jews, almost 60% have no relationship with any organized Jewish activity. But this June, they all came forward and all participated in the rallies and the pledging and the statements of concern. And so it was in France, which is today the fourth largest Jewish community, having some 400,000 Jews. In France, Jews, of course, were in a very difficult position, given General de Gaulle's active antipathy to what he calls warlike Israel with its expansionist urges. He began even to speak of the Jews as an elite domineering people. But the French Jews, who have not any tradition, as we do in America, of sometimes standing up on our haunches and saying what we think, the French Jews have always prided themselves on being more French than Jews. Even the French Jews finally allowed their chief rabbi to call Mr. de Gaulle by the name he should have been called, and Mr. de Gaulle backed down, at least publicly, at a New Year's convocation just a week ago. The existence of Israel affects our lives preeminently. It is the rally and the focus. And it is also the danger, because it has brought new attitudes, new emotions to bear upon our lives. These cannot be forgotten. 1967 ends. It ends as every Jewish year ends, with danger and with life, with a philosophic attitude towards the present, with faith in the future. What will 1968 bring? Hopefully it will bring world concern with peace in the Middle East. Hopefully it will bring a clear understanding of our responsibilities to fellow Jews throughout the world. Hopefully it will continue this rally of courage and of conviction by which we drew together, and we drew on our deepest resources, and we gave of them to the needs of Israel. And as a rabbi, I would add this. Hopefully 1968 will remind us that we cannot ultimately depend upon the emotions centered upon Israel to carry Judaism through. Judaism requires education, learning. Judaism requires a discipline of worship, and a discipline of practice. I mentioned the Argentine. There are 90,000 children of school age, Jewish children of school age in the Argentine. There are 15,000 who go to any kind of a Jewish religious school, and of those, over 5,000 are in kindergartens. In other words, 1 in 9 children receive any Jewish education. In the United States, the figures are higher. But here, can we claim that our education is what it ought to be, that enough hours are invested in it, that we continue education beyond that point where it is childish and juvenile? Can we claim that the Jewish ethos permeates our home and is part of our lives? There have been 2 Jewish commonwealths. This is the third. The first 2 went down in flames. We had determined that this one must survive. But our people have learned also that for the survival of the Jewish commonwealth, the survival of the diaspora is essential, is quintessential. Our strength is theirs. They need our political support, our economic support, and our spiritual support. If they lack that support, the one true foundation which is theirs outside their own small country, they lack the largest part of the military, of the political and of the social leverage which is theirs. And we cannot live only off of their achievements. We must live off of our own. And our achievements must be the achievements of identity, must be the achievements of happiness within our peopleness, must be achievements of humanity and of concern. We must concentrate on learning and doing, on exemplifying to ourselves and to our children what it means to be a Jew, to follow the law of God in the political arena, in the marketplace, and in the home. 1967 ended with a year of miracle. It was a year of danger. This has been the eternal pattern of Jewish life. It will be the pattern of Jewish life for many years to come. Pray God, then, that we will have the courage and the faith to meet its challenge. Amen.